Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
You're listening to Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. This is Valley Roundup. This week, a look back on the news stories that made up 2017. An American takes home World Cup gold in Aspen. The Glenwood Springs Bridge stops traffic. A deadly summer on the Valley's 14ers sparks conversation about the backcountry. And the Valley reacts to Trump's America. All that and more coming up on Valley Roundup. Joining me today, the guys who watched every moment unfold, Curtis Wackerly from the Aspen Daily News. Thanks for being here, Curtis.
Thanks for having me.
And Rick Carroll from the Aspen Times. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thank you both for joining me. So the year started out with a bit of a celebration around Aspen. The city pulled off a World Cup championship race, and that was kind of a high note.
It was a very high note. It was like five or six races. It was the whole World Cup finals. It was a massive event that had been in the planning stages for, I don't know, at least a good 2 or 3 years of pretty intense focus. And it was the biggest ski racing event that had happened in Aspen maybe ever. I mean, certainly in a generation. You could make an argument about some earlier things, 1950 FIS championships
might have
something to say about that. but the 2017 World Cup finals were awesome. And there were so many people here, just 8 deep along the sides of the course watching the best skiers in the world.
And Rick, the city itself got a lot of praise for pulling it off.
Yes, they helped out with Wagner Park. And it was a great event, though. Just lots of energy for all ages. And I'll take that over the U.S. Pro Challenge any day.
I
digress.
Aspen's, we have this reputation for being like really rich and ritzy. It's like we paid off the entire event gods. It was 60 degrees and sunny, yet we had snow on the mountain. It was beautiful. And the international stage, everyone was watching. So that seemed like a big high. One of the things that comes out of that World Cup, though, is the lift that all the pros were taking to get to the top of the run, lift 1A. That was a big issue all year as well.
Well, you just managed to throw in Aspen political controversy into this pure ski racing.
As
Michaela
Schifrin
won the Golden Globe, okay? but yes, these two things have managed to be intertwined, perhaps unfairly. But the reality is that side of the mountain has been, a lot of people would say in dire need of upgrades for a while. A lot of people would say it's just fine how it is. However, it's been debated for a long time, I think since before either Rick or I even started, as to how are you going to develop this very valuable underdeveloped real estate and remake this base portal to Aspen Mountain, and no one can agree on that, of course. So in the meantime, we have a 1970 chairlift that is not really up to FIS standards. They're pretty pretty serious about those. And we don't really know when we're going to get the next World Cup race, because we're sort of in a turning point as to how that site is going to be developed. And it's going to be under construction probably for 15 years.
And the parties are purportedly trying to negotiate, trying to find a compromise over this lift, or that's where they left it, right, with council?
Yeah, it's very much on the table right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a council, there were some interesting things that came out during that, I think. Basically, you have a hotel proposal that is going to buy all this land that's right where the lift is now, and they're going to build this big hotel, and part of the deal is they're going to throw in a new lift. Their proposal has a lift in the same place it is now. Now, that you really have to understand Aspen, understand why people care about this. But a lot of people would like to see that bottom terminal moved about 2.5 blocks down the hill to Dean Street. So you don't have to walk up this big hill to get to the lift, thereby easing access to Aspen Mountain, making it, more publicly accessible. And so there's been a huge, whether or not you can actually pull this off is a matter of great debate, because you have lots of other property owners, lots of other interested parties, but they agreed to take a serious look at it this summer. They hired a third-party consultant who came back and said, yeah, you could actually do this, but you have all these variables that would have to come to fruition, and we don't really know if that's going to happen yet. But
so
you know,
Gorsuch, at the bottom of the mountain there, is talking about that trade of land for a lift, essentially. But one of those options that the third party came back and said was, well, you would have to actually make that lift come through a building that hasn't been built yet, and that's where the negotiations come in, that there's this other developer.
The Brown brothers and
Jason Grossfeld.
Right.
We have this theoretical building that is in the way of a lift, but it is all intertwined because they're saying we need they're attaching development to a lift, and they're attaching that they're saying we need the new lift because we need races like the World Cup here, and it wouldn't come here if we didn't have the lift. I mean, this would just be a hotel proposal if they didn't have that dangling out that, hey, we can be better if we have a better lift.
Sure. I mean, that's definitely part of it. You know, I think it's clear that we're not going to have another World Cup race until there's a new lift there. There will be one way or the other, but we just have to decide whether or not we want it to come down the hill a little bit. And, you know, good luck with that, I guess.
And we did see that stall out. City Council basically told the Gorsuch proposal, we're not going to say yes or no on this. You have to work on it harder. So that stalled out in 2017. Moving right along to other things that define Aspen's character that came through this year. We saw the very conclusion of the moratorium. That was mostly a 2016 thing, but there was a couple measures that were still on the table that had to be approved early on. And I want to wrap that in with the citizen-led chain store ordinance that got passed early this year. Rick, what was your take on that ordinance?
Well, it was, like we were saying, the developers will shoot for the stars and settle for the moon sometimes. And I think that's what happened with this chain ordinance. In a bit of irony, I think it lost a lot of teeth, and it basically just slows down future development in the core. But is it really going to put a halt to chain stores coming? I don't see it.
It's interesting. I mean, I think clearly what this was targeted at was trying to, you know, tamp down sort of the rampant speculation that we saw in the Aspen commercial core in the years sort of leading up to 2017. We had, you know, the Boogie's building going for, what, $27 million?
$27.5 million,
based on the promise that you can sign up these high-end national brands that will pay absurd lease rates. And so this was targeted square at that. You can debate whether or not it's really going to have an effect. I mean, we've only had a couple of proposals come through since this was passed.
I was wondering that.
One of which, and so I don't even know if the proposal has actually been filed yet, but it's the White House Tavern, which is, you know, this small, cute, fairly expensive Aspen restaurant. It happens to be owned by a chain, but there's not another White House. I mean, I shouldn't say it's owned by a chain. It's owned by a restaurant corporation that has lots of other restaurants. Apparently, there's no other White House Tavern. That's like a unique thing. And so they just bought the building next door, and they say they're, you know, they're going to tear it down. They're going to rebuild it. And they're going to put some kind of restaurant in there probably, but they don't really know what it is. But it's going to be something different, so it's not going to qualify as a chain. I think the bigger impact, honestly, in the chain store ordinance is the land use code changes that came up through the city, through the planning office, which basically say you have to build smaller buildings. You have to include more, you know, pedestrian amenity, walkways, second tier spaces, which is a whole other term we learned this year.
we had a 2017 dictionary.
Yeah. And so that, you know, I think that's going to drive future development much more than this, you know, this chain store ordinance, which has sort of debatable impact.
And you're saying that we have only seen that one application since the moratorium stuff has gone in?
There's been a few other applications, but I don't think any that are sort of downtown commercial projects that have come up new. And this application from the White House people hasn't actually been filed yet unless it's happened in the last week or two. So we haven't.
I'll race you to the building department.
Yeah, let's go.
You're listening to Valley Roundup from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Putting the whole year in perspective for us today are Curtis Wackerly from the Aspen Daily News and Rick Carroll from the Aspen Times. We're looking back on the defining stories of 2017, and I think for the rest of my life, I'll always think of 2017 summer, what happened this summer with all the deaths and rescues out in our backcountry. And without going back over how each one of those went down, I kind of want an insight from both of your newsrooms. As the press releases kept coming in, as the stories kept coming in, how do you handle that? How do you tell that story? How do you react to, oh, we're seeing a trend now?
Well, it's one of the hardest parts of the job when you have to report on tragedy. I think we become somewhat used to a certain amount, you know, in the summer. It seems like more and more so, just because there's so many people out there. And it's really sad, but the mountains are dangerous and things are going to happen. And it's really, honestly, it's been like that for a long time. You know, you get used to the pick and alert, mountain rescue office press releases coming in. A lot of times they're for pretty innocuous stuff. And we just had one the other day about someone who got lost on the Sunnyside Trail.
But when the sun set, it's just a little too ironic.
But then, you know, you get the big ones. And especially in the summertime, you have helicopters flying around trying to pluck people off the side of these really gnarly mountains. So I just want to say that that's been there.
Okay.
It's not like this was a new thing that there were a lot of backcountry rescues. Just the severity of it was really rough this year. And we had a lot of, you know, a lot of really sad deaths, more so than we've become accustomed to.
But one of the common denominators in this was on Capitol Peak. It was
five on Capitol.
You can only summit it, from what I understand, by crossing Knife Edge. And you got to go back the same way you came. And in these instances, the deceased felt that they could get down another way, and it didn't work out.
So that sparked this conversation of how much signage, how much knowledge should we either require of someone before they can go up there? Should we be putting signs? There's one route, and there's a whole camp that says, no, these are beautiful spaces. Don't Disneyland them up. Don't make them any easier, because that's what's happening, is that people who don't have the skills yet to climb these 14ers are relying on, well, there's signs that'll just show me.
It's tough. I mean, how do you tell someone what they can or can't do? I mean, these are public lands. You know, the signage debate, it's tough. Like, is that going to help? Right. Is that enabling? I don't know. It's you hear a lot of people say, well, if there's a sign that says you must go this way and that saves even one life, like, why would you not do that? Yeah, I don't know. What's the counter argument? I guess that it doesn't. Well, I don't know. What is the counter argument?
That false sense of security,
right?
I think.
That
like, just because there's a sign doesn't mean it's easy.
I think that people who want to do this should watch those YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And if you've seen those, if you're not that adept or you haven't done this before, you might want to just check those out, because those are gnarly.
I mean, near 90-degree face at some of the crossing.
If you fall, the funny part is, it's like the Knife Edge. You hear that's people get over that. It's when they, you know, if they're getting too scared and they don't want to cross it again, that's when they get themselves
into
trouble, or they get off route someplace else. Or now, did you guys see the photo on the cover of Aspen Sojourner this summer that showed like 8 people crawling across it? It was a pretty interesting perspective. I would add that to the list of you should check this out before you go.
Right.
And just be educated. I mean, that's the problem, is people get over their heads.
Yeah.
And I do think there's also this mentality in this town, for better or worse, that it's go higher, go harder, go farther. You know, it doesn't always have to be that way. and I think there's that competitive spirit, which is good. It's a healthy way to live, but you got to keep yourself in check. You have to be what you are, not what you aren't, when you're trying to climb these things.
It's a culture thing a little bit.
Yeah.
When you talk about education, Curtis, I want to talk about Mountain Rescue Aspen. They do these avalanche backcountry classes and trainings throughout the winter. This brought up the question, should we be having these same type of courses for summer backcountry?
I think absolutely. I mean, clearly the message has not gotten out there sufficiently that these are dangerous mountains, and you shouldn't really start your mountain climbing career with capital.
Right.
You know, you need to build up to that. It deserves tremendous respect. And I think if Mountain Rescue can help get that out there in this saturated social media age, then that is 100% on mission for what they do, and it would be a benefit to the community. And I think they are doing that, right? Didn't they have something this fall, and mm-hmm. they're working on it?
Yeah. And just to recognize that that is an all-volunteer organization. Yeah. They went on 30 missions. 8 of those were body recoveries this summer. That, you know, those are our community members, too. We yeah. did lose community members in these tragedies, but we also have these community members who are walking around town having experienced that and carrying that
yeah,
on their shoulders.
The Mountain Rescue folks too, I mean, they're on call, they're doing this, and it was just like boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. Not only the physical effect, but you have to imagine, I mean, you're asking us how we handle it. Mm-hmm. Nothing compared to these guys. Yeah. I mean, an emotional impact on them, it's got to be fatiguing.
You're listening to Valley Roundup from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Putting the whole year in perspective for us today are Curtis Wackerly from the Aspen Daily News and Rick Carroll from the Aspen Times. I don't know if there is a commemorative plaque, but I want something on the new Glenwood Avenue Bridge, like stamped 2017. That is so indicative of what we, like, that is the year that happened. The traffic delays, this huge project. Were either one of you stuck in that traffic? Did you go down there during that time?
No. I love Independence Pass, but and I love Glenwood too, but no, we avoided it.
We heard that it would take you an extra hour plus if you went through at the wrong time. I might have got caught in one pre-traffic jam, like before they went full shutdown in
right.
mid-August. They were, you know, there were temporary closures and backups and things like that, which is enough to make me think maybe we should steer clear. I mean, let's not minimize the impact on anyone who lives on the other side of this bridge that had to commute to Aspen every day. I mean,
we were hearing 3-hour commutes, right?
Right. Up to, well, if you're coming from Silt, it's already about an hour 15 plus. So yeah, add another hour and a half onto that and you're close to the 3-hour mark. I mean,
that's brutal.
That's yeah. brutal.
Because so much of that, I think you're not moving. I think it really, you know, it right. stopped traffic. And the communities around did stuff to mitigate that. The city of Aspen tried to offer housing so that employers right. here could just keep people up Valley right. to avoid
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think they really did a good job of kind of making this like Y2K.
And, right, Carmageddon.
But it was, I think they needed to. Because yeah. otherwise, right. You know, commuters would have been, you know, outraged if they didn't know about this. So no, you're right. You can't downplay what people had to go through getting up here. And I think an hour and 15 minutes from Silt is a very generous.
Yeah. right. On, you know, yeah. on the best.
Yeah. You're talking about a Sunday with no traffic,
right,
an hour
right,
and 15.
Right.
Or, you know, whatever. But during a rush right. hour, it's
probably
just
a 2-hour
without
drive
the bridge.
Without the bridge.
Yeah.
Sure. No, you're right. I mean, the hotel revenues in Aspen for the month of October were up like 30% because a lot of these guys would just stay at a, you know, at a Aspen hotel and off-season rates. I'm sure if, you know, a lot of the construction guys, their boss probably paid for it. You know, it was definitely an all hands on deck thing. I think RAFTA deserves a tremendous
right.
amount of credit, and the government's funded additional RAFTA service. So RAFTA stepped up to the plate, and I'm sure the scheduling challenges were monstrous to run a bus every 15 minutes on the Hogback route, which, you know, normally is what, at every half hour at best service. And they had, the riders responded. There was a lot of people that got on the bus.
So that brutalness of sitting in the car, it actually formed a little bit of a community, though. We already have this Roaring Fork Swap Facebook page. I think there was a spinoff of, like, Waiting in My Car Facebook page, and videos were posted. People were really trying to go out and force for the local businesses in Glenwood Springs that are right there under the bridge. So, you know, traffic's being rerouted away from these businesses, and I think the community came out. As silly as, like, a traffic problem is, if that's your biggest problem, I think it did really impact people's days and then really create community, which was fun to watch.
Yeah. They got the bridge done early. We should probably note that,
right?
Which is great. I mean, we had some nice weather, which probably aided that. But good,
I mean, it's
on
a massive infrastructure over the Colorado River.
Right.
I've never heard of a development project ending on time, let alone early, and they.
Right.
They pulled it off, and it's beautiful.
Wouldn't you know, as soon as it was done, we made our first desert trip.
Our producer.
Yeah, other than that first, the first week of construction or the first day or two, there was that collapse.
Right. Caught on video.
Kind of a dubious start, but after that, it panned out.
Yeah, and so now no problems we've heard, right? And our producer, Kristen Kay, says it took her 20 minutes less to get to Denver now, so it's... So it's maybe bringing business back, you know, in a way that was always a frustrating experience in the past.
But I think it's remarkable that, just to your point, that was the biggest public infrastructure project on the Western Slope in 25 years. So I don't know if maybe the bar is a little low there, but it is it's a huge deal.
No, it was a big deal. Both like the what they had to undergo and the money put into it, I think.
Yes.
It was a big year for the Aspen Skiing Company as well, so let's end on that. The Valley's largest employer had a couple of things happen. They became even bigger. They've been making purchases to kind of expand their reach, and they rolled out this new marketing campaign. They're trying to redefine themselves. Those don't necessarily go hand in hand. Let's talk first about their world takeover ambitions. What did we see this year?
Well, just to be clear, that's not quite the Aspen Skiing Company. The owners of the Aspen Skiing Company, the Crown family, partnered with KSL, which is a private equity, right? It's kind of real estate type deal.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they already were in the ski resort business. They already had Squaw Valley and Alpine and were proposing big time development over there in North Tahoe. But this was really in response to Vail. Vail Resorts has like, what, how many? 16 different resorts, and they offer the Epic Pass. You know, they're the big dog in the ski vacation industry, and no one was really coming close to them. And I think this is a play to, you know, to compete with that.
So it won't be called the Aspen Skiing Company at each one of these resorts, and we're kind of keeping our management and structure here, though we did have one top executive jump ship.
Correct. Right. We don't even know the name yet, by the way. They haven't – this new company doesn't have an official name. Like, no one knows what to call it. It's like Mega Ski Co.
Yeah. But it's privately held on, like, Vail, which is public. I don't know if that'll change, but that's a distinguishable difference between the two.
But what happened was they came out in the spring and announced they were buying Interwest.
Okay.
Which has a bunch of ski – you know, so that brought, like, Steamboat – the lease for Winter Park. What else? What else was on Interwest? There were a couple other. There's one or two other big ones there. But I think when Vail got Whistler and Park City, I think it was like, oh,
here, we have to play this game too.
Yeah.
As far as that affects the Valley, then maybe in the future we see one of these similar to the Epic Passes, where our local ski pass gets us into some other resorts. But you're saying it probably won't affect our economy or our style of what we're seeing.
I wouldn't say that. I think, there will be a pass of some kind. We don't know what it is yet. We think they're going to debut it, you know, probably at the end of this winter going into the next season. You know, there's all these other resorts. And I suspect that there will be something like the Epic Pass to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, the Aspen ones are still going to be off, you know, on this pedestal. And it's you know, like with a lot of the Epic Passes, you only get 10 days at Vail, but you get unlimited to all these other places. So it'll probably be something like that, right? Like, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it'll be a free-for-all. We'll see. There are some implications, but I don't think we quite know what they are yet.
I mean, the Epic Passes... practically free. I don't know how you can compete with that. I mean, what is it? It's like $500 or something?
It depends.
Unlimited skiing on...
But it's still, for
a
all...
A third of what we pay here our best day.
I mean, a $1,300 pass to the Aspen Skiing Company Resorts is... Yeah, you're right. Like, how do you... You can't
super
really...
Super early...
Chamber.
Right.
Chamber.
Right.
Right. $1,300.
Right.
Let's talk about how the Aspen Skiing Company... has rebranded itself in a big announcement this fall, right before going into the ski season. It also wraps up a lot of other things we saw in our community this year, because it is a not very veiled resistance to the Trump administration. So some things we saw throughout the year were the Women's March came to Aspen. It's the first political march that anyone I've talked to has seen in this community. We've seen our Picken County Sheriff get scolded by ICE for being part of this sanctuary community. So Aspen Skiing Company kind of picked up some of this resistance and ran with it. They have four different very blunt campaigns in support of things that the Trump administration might be crushing down on, gay marriage and our Gay Ski Week pride and things like that.
I personally like what SkiCo did on that front. I mean, I think that you also have to be very careful as a large company what you're doing to not come across as hypocritical also. But, I mean, for the most part, I liked it. I love to say I don't like the hashtag Aspen Way. There's something very pompous about that. But I know that you got to do it to get more hits and, you know, get more attention and all that. But it just seems a little bit like we're better than you. But I agree with the message.
Can it bleed into the community? I mean, it's not Aspen, the city, who's saying this. It's a company that is in Aspen. But will this become the Aspen Way, that in Aspen you're pro environmental protections, you are fine with Gay Ski Week? Though, like, is this a cultural thing?
I mean, I think they're definitely, this community has worn its progressive values on its sleeve for a long time now, and the ski company has increasingly, been right there on a lot of things, certainly on national issues. A lot of work on climate change has been a part of the program for quite some time now. I think most of the community, if you took a poll, probably agrees with this. So I think they know their audience,
right?
And they feel like they're one, it's a great marketing campaign, and two, it's reflective of local values. So I don't think they see any downside.
And if you follow the money to the Crowns, you'll see that they've. Right. Have a history of donating money to Democratic causes and candidates.
Yeah. Big early Obama backers.
So you don't see this as we're picking up on the news of the moment kind of gimmick. You think this campaign might define the Aspen Skiing Company for ways to come?
I definitely think there's some of that, it being relevant in the current conversation. I mean, this all started when Mike Kaplan wrote an op-ed. I think it ran last December.
In the Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal, it was, the Trump election was still raw.
Okay, right.
and it said, we're still here. So we still have these values that are very progressive. And, you can say all your nasty stuff, Trump, but, we're still going to stand up for all these things. And so that's really where it started. And there was a lot of discussion about that. It was, like Rick said, it was very mainly positive and people agreed with that. And I think they decided to kind of run with that.
Here we are a year later, still maybe a little raw in 2017. So many more things happened in 2017, of course, but that is our time for today. I very much want to thank Rick Carroll from the Aspen Times for coming in to discuss.
Thank you.
And Curtis Wackerly from the Aspen Daily News.
Thanks, Allison.
You've been listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. You can get a rundown of links and more information on these stories at aspenpublicradio.org. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.